This is FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. Up next, Ecotopia, and we'll be talking about how mushrooms rule the world. This is KZFR 90.1 Chico, and you are listening to Ecotopia, a weekly program exploring ecosystems, environmental, social, and technological. This afternoon, we'll be talking with Chita Chudi, farmer, rancher, mycologist, and by way of full disclosure, our son. He'll be talking with us about the world of fungi, larger and more complicated than you might imagine, and he'll tell us about butte remediation and his efforts to educate people about mushrooms. Ecotopia is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Chico's Certified Farmers Markets, featuring three markets in Butte County, year-round Wednesday morning in Chico at the North Valley Plaza, Saturday year-round at 3rd and Wall in downtown Chico, and a seasonal market Tuesday mornings in Paradise. The Chico's Certified Farmers Markets, connecting farmers and food lovers since 1980. And we want to remind you that the opinions voiced on Ecotopia do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. And here's our interview with Chita Chudi. This is Ecotopia on KZFR 90.1 Chico.
I'm Susan Chudi.
And I'm Stephen Chudi.
Our guest this afternoon is Chita Chudi, and as you may guess from his name, Chita is our son. Chita is also a farmer, rancher, and mycologist, and with his wife, Samantha Zangrilli, proprietor of Turkey Tail Farm in Yankee Hill, California. Tonight, he's here to talk with us about fungi. In the first half of the program, we'll talk about the world of fungi, or fungi. In the second half, we'll learn about Chita's work with fungi. Thanks for talking with us, Chita.
You may tell us how to pronounce fungi or fungi as we get going, but how did you first get interested in those creatures?
Well, I accept fungi and fungi either way. Neither one gives me heartburn. It's all about the same group of organisms, you'd almost say. So I came about fungi from an interest in mushroom compost. Actually, I saw somebody's community garden that had huge success, and I was wondering where did this mushroom compost come from? And there's lots of different kinds of mushroom compost that are rich in different nutrients. But initially, I started researching this mushroom compost and learned that fungi have this capability of breaking down pollutants. And it took me on this whole path of trying to learn about mushroom bioremediation. And through that, I got excited about mushroom cultivation as a food source. I really like growing mushrooms for human consumption to give to my community to produce food from basically wood chips and straw. And so it was kind of this roundabout way of coming to really loving to eat mushrooms from observing compost.
And you had some experience in your college days. Could you tell us a little bit about how that plays into your current work?
Yeah, I was very fortunate to have teachers and mentors that were fungi focused. Martha Rosemeyer was a mycorrhizal expert. Those are the fungi that work in association with roots and increase the potential growth of plants. I had Paul Przybylowicz, who was a prolific author and mycological consultant for many years, and after much badgering, he became my teacher as well for independent study, where I was able to learn about mushroom genetics and breeding through him. And so I was just very fortunate to have this great group of teachers around me when I was struck with the bug, as we say.
What are fungi?
Fungi. Yeah, you're allowed to say it either way, in my opinion. So fungi are these, so we're most familiar with the mushroom itself. We walk out into the woods and we see a toadstool, we see a bracket fungus, a shelf fungus growing off a tree, and we see this organism out there in the woods, and we don't fully understand it. I feel we've been taught a lot about photosynthesis, like the way plants grow through our education system, but we don't understand fungi. And so when you see this mushroom in the woods, when you see this toadstool, this is the reproductive portion of the fungus. It's the flower of the mushroom. Its sole purpose is to spread its progeny into the world and make the next generation of fungus. Fungi, as we know it among mycologists, is the below ground portion. It's and I'll say these words several times, the mycelium, the hyphae. So these are the root-like portions of the fungus that are growing under the ground. And fungi fundamentally get their energy from other organisms. They're what we call heterotrophs. They use other people's source of carbon, their source of sugars, their source of energy as their own. So while plants can make their energy from the sun, fungi degrade the products of these organisms, the sugars, the carbohydrates, the wood, and make their own body. So yeah, fungi, they're throughout our environment, they fill a host of processes, but fundamentally, just like you and I, use somebody else's energy source as their own.
So how big is the world of fungi? I mean, is it like, I'm looking into our back garden right now, is it everywhere under the ground? And how widely does it spread? And how does it spread? Does it spread?
So yeah, fungi are throughout our environment. I break them down into three major classes. These are the saprophytes, the decomposers. So these are the fungi that only eat dead stuff. Log in the woods, moldy pile of straw. There's a whole host of ways that decomposers are a big part of the engine in our world. Your compost pile is dependent on these decomposers, these saprophytes. Second group, I would say, are parasites. So this is the mold on your cabbage. This is the late blight that killed your tomatoes too early. So fungi are throughout your garden in one way or another acting as attacking on living things. The third part, I would say, are symbiotes. These are the fungi that work in conjunction with other organisms. So the prime and maybe earliest example of this is lichen. So lichen are the things that are the lacing on your trees. They're the little things you see ordaining your pines and oaks. This is a symbiotic organization of fungi and algae. They've gotten together, and they were perhaps the first and earliest form of symbiosis. Commonly understood as mycorrhizae, these are the fungi that live in association with the roots of your plants. They extend the root zone of your plant, perhaps fight off some of the parasitic organisms that we mentioned earlier, and they also improve the uptake of nutrients. And then we have other forms of symbiotes like endophytic fungi, which live in the upper leaf area of the plants. But we can, yeah, open a can of worms right there.
So do plants need fungi? Is it required for them to have those things under the ground that are making things happen in their systems?
So ecologically speaking, evolutionarily speaking, fungi and plants, I believe, have co-evolved. That's my personal opinion. Plants are not stupid. They can adapt. They can do their own thing. And if they wanted to extend their root zone in a certain way, they could. And at a certain point, I think it just made more sense to work with fungi, again, in an evolutionary sense. And they decide to create this relationship, and they've moved together ever since. I believe parasites have their place in the world as well. I think things need to be brought back into cycle when they get out of hand. And so, while it's simple to say that, oh yeah, mycorrhizal fungi, they help plants and they receive nutrients, it's not always the case. We've learned that it's this ever-changing relationship between symbiotic fungi and parasitic fungi, where it's an ever-changing world and fungi may play a part in that balance.
Do you have any idea how many fungi there are around the planet? I know that's probably an impossible question, but
I've thought the same question myself. I mean, I would think by weight that fungi, they're made out of chitin, and so them along with crustaceans might be the heaviest amount of organism in the world by their tissue weight. Probably cellulose, wood is the primary structure in the world. But we can look at the world and see fungi all around us. I mean, from bread, beer, and brie cheese, our kombucha to tempeh to salami, like we have fungi to thank for so many things. And so maybe perhaps not by weight, but by calculus, they hold a great amount of significance for us.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking also just in raw numbers, varieties.
They are large.
Are there estimates of that?
Yeah, I couldn't call them.
Like a gazillion, probably.
Yeah, largely undefined is what we find. So in a given tree, even, you could have multiple mycorrhizal fungi living inside the roots of it. You could have multiple parasites working its way into it. And you can have hundreds, if not thousands, of endophytic fungi doing different things. Some of them are only a couple millimeters in diameter. Some of them run throughout the length of this entire tree. Fungi run deeper than we understand, and it's going to stay that way for a while. It's just, it's a black box for most of science right now, and more funding needs to be applied to it to better understand how fungi are the drivers of this planet.
I also read that there's like a fungus that is like an acre or something like that. I mean, that it's that one fungus can be huge.
Yes. Yeah. The it's commonly called the humongous fungus.
Humongous fungus.
It's arguably the largest organism on this planet.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's about 8,000 plus years old, they think. It's actually a parasitic fungus. It's destroyed a whopping 3.4 acres of forest, and it continues to persist. So it's just wiped out a swath of trees. It's actually an arguably pretty edible mushroom. And they've tested the genetics from one side of this 3.4 acres
3.4
swath and then tested the genetics from the other side, it's the same organism. So, yeah, fungi are capable of doing some heavy lifting.
Where's that one located? Is it?
It's Oregon.
Oregon. So we could visit it. Don't take a nap on this.
Yeah, don't.
It'll eat you. So you've talked a little bit. Oh, this is Ecotopia on KZFR, and we're talking with Cheetah Judy, mycologist, rancher, and farmer. And you've talked about this a little bit. And I don't know if you have more to say about it, but the role that fungi play in the natural world in the three different kinds of mushrooms, that types of mushrooms that you talked about. Are there things that we don't know about them? I mean, you said it's kind of a black box, so there's a lot more to be learned about what fungi are doing.
They're a very diverse group. They take on very many lifestyles, very many habits. Their genetics are very, very complex. Currently in your hindgut of your body right now, living inside your right now is probably Candida albicans. And so Candida albicans is this unique fungus that will grow as a filamentous fungus. It'll grow in these linear threads as long as it can. And then it will actually exit your intestinal system and reach into your blood system, at which point this fungus will turn into a yeast.
Oh.
And it will freely live in your bloodstream. And then the scariest part of all is when a killer T cell, one of your white blood cells, engulfs this yeast cell, this fungus will decide to turn back into a filament and grow out of the white blood cell and re-enter your system that way. Fungi have very unique ways of working around things. And another form of Candida right now is presenting a huge problem to the hospital systems right now, because antibiotics don't work, because we owe antibiotics to fungi. It's a penicillin. It's a bread mold. Mm-hmm. So fungi, they're entrenched in our system. We thank antibiotics to fungi, and they present problems as well. So,
So Candida can make you sick, right? I mean, it can be an illness.
Yeah, it can
yeast infections and that sort of thing.
Yes, correct. And you know, indigestion, and some propose that it create sugar and alcohol cravings as well.
Oh, interesting.
Because the fungus wants to feed itself on free sugars, and so yeah, it starts as a hindgut infection and can expand to a blood infection. The complexity of fungi it can't be defined clearly. It's hard to sum up.
Are there other roles that they play in the natural world, other things that you've studied or know about? Or we could go on to what people have started to use have used fungi for.
Like antibiotics.
Antibiotics is one example.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we can definitely thank fungi for antibiotics. So the penicillin inoculation that we get comes from the penicillin fungus. It was initially discovered because somebody that was researching Staphylococcus bacterium left their petri dish over the weekend, and the penicillin fungus somehow infected his petri dish. It grew into it and showed a positive effect in destroying the Staphylococcus. And so this countrywide research program was launched where people were asked to send in their mold. They wanted your bread mold. And some woman sent a cantaloupe that was covered in penicillin fungus, and it was shown to create a large amount of these antibiotics that fungi use to fight off other organisms in their world. So the very creation of antibiotics as we know it now originally were owned to fungi. You know, how we decide to use them now, that's a whole thing altogether. But
I remember the story of the discovery of penicillin by Fleming and that story of the Petri.
Yes.
I learned that in high school, and he came back on the weekend. There was the Petri dish, and there's just a big circle of deceased whatever surrounding it, and a clear spot in the middle, which is where the penicillin fungus was.
Yep, that's exactly
it. So I've been told.
That's exactly it. Yeah, no, it's this. Yeah, the it was by serendipity. Fate favors the prepared. We see something that happened, and hopefully can grab hold of it. But yes, it was the Fleming work. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What other uses have people made of fungi in producing things?
So. Much of our modern food is dependent, of course, on fungi. But we continue to kind of push the envelope. People have developed this meat-based or fake meat product called Quorn with a Q. And it's actually another mold fungus, basically fusarium, that they aggregate. They run it through this bath of liquid nutrient, and they tie it all together, and it tastes like a piece of chicken afterwards. And then IKEA, I think, has been working with making fungal-based packing materials. So instead of using styrofoam, instead of packing styrofoam into these forms, they pack mushroom growth material in there and grow fungi to make fake styrofoam. And, you know, the future of it, I think, and I hope, as people are going to continue to push the envelope on eating plastics with fungi. This is something that's been, people have been working on for maybe 10 years, but basically they're using the same fungal enzymes to degrade wood as they would to degrade plastics. These phenolic plastics, they call them. And so here we have this huge problem with plastics in the oceans. They're accumulating. And if somebody were to knock through and fix out how to industrialize, how to break down plastics with fungi, we might have a solution to the plastics problem. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a heavy rock to move, but the enzymatics material, the enzymatic suite is in place. The same enzymes that fungi use to break down wood can be used to break down motor oil and plastics.
So how do you sick the fungi on motor oil? What do? You just drop some mushrooms in a pile of oil, or how does that work?
So coming back to that word mycelium, we need a lot of mycelial mass. We need a lot of mushroom root to functionally break down hydrocarbons or any sort of polycyclics or phenol groups. And so we do need a lot of mushroom mass. We need to grow a lot of mushrooms right now to mix into the motor oil laden soil, to mix into the plastic damage that we see in front of us. And so the big problem, I think, for bioremediation with fungi right now is finding a way to use those enzymes without having to create as much mycelial mass. I think that's the big problem that comes next.
Can you talk about the nutritional value of mushrooms? How many mushrooms do we have now that are edible? And do their nutrients vary? And some of them are better for some things, and some of them are better for other things in terms of nutrition?
So in terms of mushrooms that you typically eat in the supermarket, you're going to find button, cremini, and portobello. Those are all actually the same mushroom. It's Agaricus bisporus. It's an age-old cultivar. We've grown it for years and years. And it's probably the least medicinal or nutritional. I mean, you're going to get protein, A, D, maybe a little C vitamin. But if you're going to eat a oyster mushroom or shiitake, if you're going to eat a lion's mane, if you're going to eat a chestnut, these all have so many at times unique medicinal properties, and at the same time they hold more beneficial properties in just in terms of their quality of nutrient accessibility. So I'd say anything but button is a good mushroom to reach for.
And Can you talk a little bit more about the value to our bodies of eating, like, we eat a lot of oyster mushrooms. How is that valuable to my body to eat oyster mushrooms?
So on a fundamental level, most medicinal or gourmet mushrooms are going to have beta-glucans as a component of their cell wall. So definitely cook your mushrooms before eating them. That will help break up the components of the cell wall. Beta-glucans are functional in kind of immune support in the terms of helps inner body communication. Cellular identity is another way that it's said. When it comes to oyster mushrooms, what we're looking at on top of that basic immune function is statins. These are an anti-cholesterol compound that are found in lovastatin and Crestor as the commercial drugs. And basically, they're going to reduce bad cholesterols in your body. And I hate to use that term, bad cholesterol, but it's a cholesterol reducer. Shiitake, for example, is going to have lentinin in addition. That's an anti-cancer compound. I'm not going to remember it right now, but lion's mane helps build neural pathways, and it has implications for prevention of Alzheimer's. It's known as a brain builder. And so each medicinal or gourmet mushroom and many of the wild mushrooms have their own unique properties. And there's yet to much to learn in that capacity.
Here up at Turkey Tail Farm where we live, there are a lot of turkey tail mushrooms, mm-hmm. and actually the farm is named after turkey tail mushrooms. Tremedes, right? Is that the Tremedes?
Yeah, Tremedes versicolor is the...
Versicolor, and yeah. They're beautiful. They are versicolor.
These are shelf mushrooms. They're not shelf fungus, not popping up out of the ground.
Could you tell us about turkey tail mushrooms? First of all, describe what they look like, and then talk a little bit about the value and how you process them to get the value from them.
Yeah, so turkey tails, they're these kind of, you almost would miss them if you weren't looking when they're in the woods. They're, a shelf mushroom. And so it means it doesn't have a stem that comes out of the ground that we think of with our toadstools, say. And they have these, what we call zone 8. They're these rainbow stripes that run across the top of the mushroom in this kind of 70s color format. There's these browns, these yellows, these grays, sometimes
purples.
Mm-hmm. You get a little bit of green when the algae starts to grow on them. So they'll grow over a period of 2 weeks off the side of a rotten log. We grow them here on sterilized wood chips to make sure they're perfectly clean and grown from good materials. And so you can harvest these mushrooms. You can make a hot tea from them, and that's a good way to go. We do a double extraction tincture where we boil some of it and some of it rests in an alcohol concentration. The medicinal compounds can't survive in an alcohol concentration above 30%. So we add some that tincture water to that. So it's polysaccharide peptide and polysaccharide crestin are the two medicinal compounds that are found in it, and they're both anti-cancer compounds, and they're probably the most well documented of medicinal mushroom properties that work in conjunction with chemotherapy. So they're starting to get some ground in terms of working with conventional traditional medicine, and so in that way they're unique to their own. So, yeah.
You keep using the word toadstool. What's a toadstool?
So, toadstool is... I only use toadstool because it's a familiar term to talk about a mushroom cap. It creates that, that positive image of a mushroom with a stem and a cap. Mushroom, for me, means a lot of different things. Some of them are little amorphous blobs that occur on the side of a log. Some of them are underground and never see the light of day. A mushroom, for me, can mean a lot of things. And so that's where we... And
the mushroom, toadstool means the one with the stem and the cap.
Yeah, yes. The one you see on the poster.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and so that's the only way... I feel it helps to invoke kind of that mushroom image,
right?
That we'd like to see.
And you have to be careful with mushrooms, right? When you're out gathering mushrooms, not all mushrooms. We have little meadow mushrooms that are, I think, like button mushrooms, or they're the wild version of button mushrooms. But you can't be sure if that's really what it is, right?
Yeah, I always caution people against mushroom hunting. It's for any given mushroom that you think you know what it is, consult three books right off the bat. You should have three books. Okay, I found a chanterelle. Okay, great. Consult three books independently. And even when you do that, don't eat the mushroom. Throw it away. Do that two more times in the field. Identify the mushroom down to the exact genus three separate times before you ever try to eat a wild mushroom. Many a time I have people text me saying they found a beautiful clutch of mushrooms using the example of chanterelle. They, oh, I got all these chanterelles. I'm like, send me pictures. And it's the jack-o'-lantern mushroom. And you will literally poop blood.
Ooh.
If you eat it. And I said, no, like that, it'll glow in the dark. It's a cool mushroom. Literally, it'll glow in the dark. It's a fascinating fungus, this jack-o'-lantern. But throw them all away. And so go slow with mushroom identification. Go slow with wildcrafting fungi. Around here, yes, we have the Agaricus campestris, which is the wild version of the button mushroom that you find out at the supermarket. So it's a dead look-alike for Campestris xerothansis, the horse mushroom. The only difference you're going to see when you harvest it on time is that if you rub the top of the mushroom gently, after a couple seconds, it'll blush yellow. And again, this will create incredible gastrointestinal dysfunction. You will not feel good for several days. And it's a very, very finite difference between them.
So if there's a poison mushroom, is it within the mushroom itself or because of what it has absorbed from the land, the wood, or whatever?
Poisonous mushrooms are definitely out for themselves. They are poisonous for a very specific reason, ecologically, historically, and they've all decided on their own habit. Edible mushrooms, they want us to eat them and then spread their spores.
Yeah.
Via our own pathways. Mushrooms that are poisonous or, moreover, just not traditionally edible, they kind of get kicked around. They get spread around different ways. I mean, as mushroom hunters, we'll typically take two and then take the third mushroom that we found and huck it out into the woods to spread the spores further. We want to perpetuate that lifestyle of getting bigger, growing larger. And so they all have their different reasons for doing what they do. Mm-hmm. And far be it from us to assume what that is. But
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I just want to ask one more question before we move on to talk a little bit more about what you've been doing in the last couple of years. Is mushroom identification all visual? I mean, you mentioned rubbing it and seeing the color change. Is there anything that you can do by smell or feel? And I know we don't want people to go out to identify mushrooms based on what you say, but I'm just curious about how you go about identifying them. I know the gills are important. If you turn it upside down, that's one way of looking.
Yeah, there's a bunch of different ways, and I'm still learning a bunch of them. So I like to tell people you can't start without a spore print. So basically what you're going to take a fungus that you just found in the woods, put it on a clean piece of white paper, and put a mug or perhaps a bowl over it, and leave it overnight, and that mushroom, because its sole purpose in life is to reproduce, to create spores, it's going to deposit its spores on that piece of paper. And then from there, honestly, that's the starting point. The color of the spore is the biggest indicator to me. The connection of the gills, as we say, to the under cap of the mushroom can provide a lot of details. Even the way you pick the mushroom can be important. The way the mushroom connects to the mycelium can be hugely important. So if you don't take your trowel, you don't take your knife and dig that mushroom out of the ground deeply, you don't know what the base of it looks like, and that can mean a lot.
Okay.
There's lots of different color indicators, the gills or the spores or the different ways in which they reproduce can all have significance. And so really that's where I say 3 books, 3 times. Don't do it. Just pick a mushroom from the woods and eat it. And even if you do pick a mushroom from the woods and eat it for the first time, confident in your identification, eat a small portion because you may be allergic.
This is Ecotopia on KZFR. We're talking with Chita Chudi. He's a farmer, rancher, mycologist, and we're talking about the world of fungi and mushrooms. We'd like to transition now to a little bit more with your experience on a Turkey Tail Farm. Could you tell us a little bit what was the role of mushrooms at Turkey Tail Farm prior to the campfire, and then we'll get into what you've been doing since then.
So yeah, part of Turkey Tail Farm is growing mushrooms. Oyster mushroom is our primary crop. We're starting to get back into shiitake and lion's mane, thankfully, and starting to grow a greater diversity of fungi here. Before the fire, we would feed the byproduct of our mushrooms to our chickens, and that was a way that we were able to circulate energy on farm. Probably the byproduct of our mushroom farming is now going to be going to compost to support our garden program. So yeah, food farming is the primary function of Turkey Tail Farm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what happened with the campfire?
So during the campfire, pretty much all of the farming infrastructure was lost. The fire swept back a couple days after Paradise burned, and pretty much everything we needed to do the work was gone. I was able to get back to the property fairly early and observe that there was widespread toxin in the environment. So I took the byproduct of our farming program, which normally fed our chickens and supported other parts of the farm, and started to use it as a bioremediation, or at least a biological barrier for the movement of toxins on property.
So you lost your home and the farm infrastructure. How did that launch you into a new project with mushrooms? And what potential did you see in fungi as you looked at what the fire had done?
So coming back to the earlier in the interview, I kind of came to fungi as an interest in their bioremediation potential. Observing kind of what was happening with Paradise and our own farm, I saw the potential for spread of contaminants, and I knew that fungi on some level were able to break down or uptake, remediate, mineralize some of the pollutants that were in the environment. And so seeing that, I just, from an armchair perspective, I kind of felt the need to initiate some sort of process to put that on a wider scale and better understand whether fungi can fulfill some of the hype in terms of their bioremediation potential.
So describe Butte Remediation. You formed Butte Remediation, and how was that project funded, and what did you do with it?
So, yeah, out of that kind of observation that there might be widespread pollution, started a program called Butte Remediation, got nonprofit status, applied to a bunch of funders. Ultimately, it was North Valley Mutual Aid. And I should be clear there, North Valley Mutual Aid was the initial funder, their grassroots program, and saw the potential themselves. And so went out to the community and found people that were left behind in the Cal OES cleanup program. These are people that were initially living in RVs without a primary structure, without a real home, or perhaps they just had burned vehicles or something like that. And for the recovery process of Butte County, FEMA and Cal OES said those properties do not get free cleanup. And so these underserved individuals, I reached out where I could and went out and tried to better understand the toxins that were left behind from the Cal OES program, and in some way, if possible, uptake, immobilize some of these toxins that were in the environment.
So what mushrooms did you use? What fungi did you use? How did you distribute them? And how did you figure out what they were actually doing in the ground?
So to start each project or each site, what I'd go and I'd test for all of the environmental pollutants that I was aware of or that might be there. So this is heavy metals. So the KM17, we're talking about lead and mercury. We're talking about antimony. We're talking about zinc. And so we test for all these different heavy metals. We test for polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, these motor oil-like substances, and PAHs. So these PAHs that there's a whole different host of types, as well as benzene, which we're familiar with in the Paradise water situation. This is a word we're now familiar with. So I test for all these pollutants. And because the only fungus really available to me in large quantities was the oyster mushroom, that's the fungus I applied to the land. So over the last 2 years, I've tried different ways of incorporating fungus to the land, trying to get contact to these toxic ashes, to these environmental pollutants. And then during the process, I would test the mushrooms that popped up to see if we're getting the pollutants we're looking for. And at the end, I would test again to see if we're getting where we're going, if we're actually achieving anything with this process.
So what did you find?
So I think I break it down into heavy metals, this, the leads, the zincs, the cadmium, the chromium. These are heavy metals. They are ions. They are individual molecules, cannot be broken down. So what we're looking to do is extract them from the soil and immobilize them, take them up and just hold them for right now so we can take them away and throw them away. The other part of it is the benzene, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, dioxins is another one. These things, they're just carbon and hydrogen. We can break them down. We can get rid of them and turn them back into inert molecules. Sure. On the persistent organic pollutants, the benzene, the dioxin, that stuff we can break down. That we can get rid of. That we can get to a healthy place. With the heavy metals, it's kind of a mixed bag. Sometimes we get really good success. Sometimes we get really significant reductions. And then some days, just nothing comes of it. And so it's a double-edged sword where I think we can do a little bit better maybe with the practices that we're putting in place after a forest fire. But it's not the ultimate end goal, silver dollar.
Silver bullet.
Silver bullet, thank you. That's what I meant.
But you said the mushrooms have been, you used the word hyped. So has there been exaggeration in the literature about the possible remediation effects of mushrooms?
Well, and that's why I came to this process. Like, this is why I did what I did, is that while laboratory studies can demonstrate the effective uptake and what we call in the soil world immobilization of heavy metals, we can hold it in place. In the real world, in vitro or in vivo situation, it might not be so successful. I think fungi hold a lot of potential for breakdown of the organic pollutants, the polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, the benzene, the dioxins. I think this is a place that we can make successful headway.
This is KZFR on 90.1 Chico, and we're talking to Chita Chudi about fungi. What can you describe your efforts at educating people about mushrooms? What have you been doing along those lines?
So my intention was to initially have some field days and do in-person education, but of course pandemic has changed all that. So just today, the Butte Remediation website is launched. So that's butteremediation.com. It's got all of the literature published. It's got every bit of data. It's a thick read. Skip over to the additional resources tab, and it's got multiple YouTube videos about how all of this is shaken down over time, as well as methods of really low-tech mushroom cultivation, really low-tech bioremediation techniques, ways that you can execute this your own self, and you can always reach out to me at butteremediation@gmail.com. I started on this path because I reached out to people that were supposedly doing bioremediation efforts, and I got no response. And so I wanted to put the information out there, I wanted to put the data out there, and I want to be available to people that are in a situation that need help, because I needed help.
What was the SARS grant for? You got a SARS grant. What, can you describe that?
Yeah, so SARE, this is the Western branch of the SARE. It's Sustainable Agriculture Research and Education Program. The intent was to build on the research that I got initially from North Valley Mutual Aid. And so I did a couple research plots here on the farm. Roughly 2 years after the fire event, we were still finding levels of heavy metal that were unacceptable. And then I also did a research project looking at pesticide residues in a farm that was transitioning from conventional agriculture to organic agriculture. So looking at the persistent lifespan of pesticides and how fungi might mitigate that.
People can also find your videos on mushrooms at on YouTube. Is that correct?
Yeah, the easiest way to do it probably is just go to butteremediation.com and then additional resources tab on the far right-hand side, and that'll take you all the videos. We also have videos on fire preparedness and recovery from people that do both every day.
And currently, I think you've already talked a little bit about this. You're growing mushrooms for food. That's your main focus right now.
Yeah, with the launch of the new website, I'm going to turn my sights towards just generating as much high-quality food as I can for the community around me. With COVID present and persistent, I've turned my sights towards a couple medicinal mushrooms that I think hold promise, specifically turkey tail, which is an immune-enhancing and anti-cancer mushroom, and the reishi fungus, which is known as an immunomodulator. So this is the concept that if you have overimmune dysfunction, it can help temper that down. So if you have eczema or something like that, but if you have underimmune activity, like you just got the coronavirus, it can help bolster your immune system. And as we've seen with the coronavirus, you get in the later stages of it an overimmune this cytokine reaction, the cytokine storm, they're calling it. And so again, the reishi mushroom could actually be functional in both supporting your immune system and quelling your overimmune activity later in the stages of the disease. So I've been hitting hard on that one, trying to get that rolling along with our other edibles.
I think listeners might enjoy hearing about the actual operation, where you sterilize things, how that operates, and then how you grow the things under in a hoop house.
Absolutely, yeah. So all the fungi we work with are the we talked about earlier, the saprophytes. They're degrading fungi, so they live on wood chips, they live on straw, anything like that. And so my job as a mushroom farmer is I create the optimal environment for this fungus to live. So first thing I do is I tailor a diet that's perfect by creating the substrates that are of a good nutritional value and the right pH, and then I sterilize them so any competing mold and bacteria are not available or not around.
And then I introduce the fungus. So I grow tiny little petri dishes out on the jars of grain. And so my job is I take a small, tiny little portion of fungus, and I just grow it exponentially, 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 until I have hundreds, if not thousands of pounds of wood chips or straw with the fungus growing on it. And then they get released into my greenhouses, where they get increased light, oxygen content, and moisture. That triggers them to produce what we call the mushroom, the toadstool itself, the fruit body, as we say in the industry. And so this fruit body grows out of this body of wood chips and straw. And that's the edible portion. That's the medicinal portion. That's the culinary treat that I get to share with my community. So my process, I like to call it barnyard alchemy, where I take wood chips and straw and I turn it into food. And that's the greatest joy of my job.
Somebody asked me the other day, they said, you're not growing them on manure, are you? Because there was legendary caves in Pennsylvania that we hear about.
Yeah, and Pennsylvania, button mushrooms is the seat of mushroom farming norms. And so, yeah, it's a manure-based, maybe a little bit of straw. But button mushrooms are kind of like old news, I feel like, mm-hmm. these days. They're a great mushroom to grow if you like them, but there's way more medicinal, there's way more delectable culinary and medicinal mushrooms out in the world, and we just need to turn our head for a minute and see some of those. They're harder to grow, maybe. Sometimes they can be more expensive to grow, but there are so many more treats than the button.
Okay, but just to be clear, no manure in your process.
Yeah, we don't use manure. Yeah.
And could you also, on your website, and I want you to give us that one more time, but you do have one video. It's not film, it's
not
video.
Not anymore.
I don't know what it is. I'm an old-fashioned girl. You have a video of showing your process of how you do the mushroom cultivation on the farm.
Yeah, so there's kind of introduction to mushroom cultivation, which kind of gives the concepts, like from the petri dish on up, and then there's the low tech, which is part two video, and it's ways that with very little technology, I mean, buy a mushroom bag from me and you can grow and grow and grow, and that's what we do. We buy one bag of growing living fungus from an organization, and we keep it for running for months at a time, and you can do it too. It's doable. It's not easy. I won't say that, but it's totally doable.
And the website again is butteremediation.com. Is that correct?
Correct. Yeah, butteremediation.com.
Okay.
We want to thank you, Chita Chudi, for being on Ecotopia this evening and talking about the wild and wonderful world of fungi and mushroom. We really appreciate you being here. And it's always exciting as parents for us to learn more and more about what you're doing. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Just a reminder of where we used to play. And I
You've been listening to Ecotopia on KZFR. Stay tuned. Coming up in just a couple of minutes, we'll hear Bobby Tryon and North State Give and Take. It's all about local nonprofits and community organizations, people doing things and being part of a solution. Also, check out kzfr.org programs to learn about our wide-ranging public affairs programs. We cover local news, social and political issues from local to global, peace, the environment, and health. KZFR itself, your community radio station. You can also check out Ecotopia. We are at ecotopiakzfr@gmail.com. We always welcome suggestions from listeners about past shows, future shows, issues you'd like to hear about. You can also listen to our previous shows. Check those out on our webpage, ecotopiakzfr.com. And we now have a podcast. You can listen to us on Anchor, on Spotify, on most of the other podcast sources. So thank you very much for listening to Ecotopia.
They paved paradise and put up a parking lot. A pink hotel, a boutique, and a swinging hat spot. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. They paved paradise, they put up a parking lot. They took all the trees, they put them in a tree museum. They charge the people a dollar and a half just to see them. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. They paved paradise, they put up a parking lot. Hey, farmer, farmer, put away the DDT. Give me spots on my apples, but leave me the birds and the bees, please. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. If you ain't paradise, you're put up a parking lot. Late last night, I heard my screen door slam. A big yellow bulldozer took away the house and land. Don't it always go to show? You never know what you got till it's gone. Big paradise, they put up a parking lot. In big paradise, they put up a parking lot. In big paradise, they put up a parking lot. Hey, paradise, the foot of a parking lot.
Coming up next is North State Give and Take, and it's made possible by generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Kenny Nursery and Topsoil, celebrating 50 years of providing bulk soils, organic fertilizers, high-octane soil amendments, and a large selection of landscape materials. Kenny Nursery and Topsoil specializes in helping you grow everything from tomatoes to cannabis. Deliveries are available from Sacramento to the Oregon border, and more information on Facebook at kennynursery.com. And by the Chico Natural Foods Cooperative, offering a variety of organic and local produce, organic groceries, and supplements. The co-op has hot food, ready-to-eat sandwiches, and cold brew coffee. The co-op now accepts online orders for curbside pickup. Chico Natural Foods Co-op open every day on the corner of 8th and Main in downtown Chico.